Coming up on the Creativity in Motion podcast, a conversation with Chef Anthony Mandriota.
It's just a beautiful sight to see eight people at a table eating your food, laughing, telling stories, and, you know, we create that for them. That's kind of why we do it.
Ready to roll?
Yep, let's do it.
Hi, my name is Mark Mosry.
And I'm Chris Hollow, and this is episode number 25 of Creativity in Motion, a podcast about creativity where we talk with creatives of all kinds to find out why they create and especially how they overcome creative obstacles.
In this episode, we're going to be visiting with Chef Anthony Mandriota and talking about the creativity that he enjoys within his job as a chef.
Before we get into it, we want to tell you about our sponsor, NoSe College of Art, and we happen to be at NoSe College of Art right now. NoSe College opened in 1973 as a fine art school and has transformed into Tennessee's only private art college. They offer bachelor's degree programs in commercial illustration, graphic design, video and film, photography, and, as we're about to talk about, we have a brand new culinary arts associate's degree. They have a beautiful 55,000 square foot facility that was built with the artistic student in mind that includes computer labs, production suites, photography and video studios, and a fully stocked equipment cage. Everything students need to get creative. To learn more about NoSe College of Art, you can visit nose.edu for degree program details, faculty information, and student work.
Let me introduce our guest today. Chef Anthony Mandriota began his career working in hotels in the Catskills region of New York. He honed his skills in restaurants and hotels on Long Island and South Florida. He has a master's degree in hospitality management, and he's chaired the culinary departments at multiple schools. Throughout his career, he's been guided by his grandmother's simple advice. Start with the best ingredients, don't crowd your pan, and eat with your eyes first. Chef Mandriota, welcome to our show.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, I love eat with your eyes first. I know I speak for Chris. We do that all the time.
I do a lot of things with my eyes first.
Yeah. It's funny to see us in a restaurant because I'll read the menu and Chris looks at the pictures and goes, I'll have that, and points to it. So it's very visual. I appreciate that advice from your grandmother.
Yeah, she was very big on that. She would put down a plate and say, if it doesn't look good, it's not going to taste good. So she made sure every plate she put out was beautiful.
That's funny because I just had a conversation with some of my photography students about food photography. And I had given them assignment to retouch a photo of some food. And the results were all over the place. And some of what they did actually made the image look good. And some of what they did actually made the image look terrible. And I had to point out, no one's going to order this if they don't look at the picture and think, this looks delicious. I want to eat this, right? And I think that that was a good way to explain that, the sort of the power of the visual leading your expectation for what you're about to taste.
Yes, definitely. Taste and smell are the two main receptors, but your eyes are the first impression.
That's really interesting because I would think of smell first because you might smell something being cooked, especially if you're in a restaurant or even outside the restaurant, you would smell it, you know, and that would lead you in by your nose like a dog or a cat.
It's like a movie trailer. You see a really awesome movie trailer and then you think, this is going to be awesome. I'm super excited. And then, you know, sometimes the movie lets you down and the trailer was better than the movie, but you know, you have expectations going into the movie.
Yeah. Or the restaurant.
Or the restaurant. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about your grandmother. She sounds like she was a really interesting woman and like you guys were perfectly in sync.
My grandmother was an amazing person, a very smart business person, shrewd for an immigrant. She knew how to, you know, the importance of every penny. And she went out and shopped and she never, you know, had anything in mind about what she was going to cook. She would just go to the store and look at what was good. Of course, back then in the 50s and 60s, it wasn't so much stores as markets. And she would just pick out the best ingredients. She had a butcher that was right downstairs from her in the same apartment building. So you never knew what you were going to get, but you always knew it was going to be great.
My dad grew up in a family restaurant. It was an American restaurant, but my dad's parents are from Lebanon. So whenever we would eat at their house, it was always Lebanese food. But their restaurant was just sort of typical American food, hamburgers and things like that. But my grandmother did all the cooking. And then she would go upstairs and do all the cooking for the family also. So it was, I remember her kitchen, and I remember it was just a giant open room, and it seemed very utilitarian, and man, so much food was made there.
It sounds like your grandmother was cooking based on intuition only. Like, there's no recipes to follow. It's what looks good, what smells good, what feels good. And she's inventing the ratio of this to that. And is that something, is that accurate? And then did that kind of migrate to what the way you cook as well?
Yes, that was definitely accurate. She never measured anything. And if we ask her for a recipe, say for, you know, her meatballs, she would tell us a few things and we'd say, no garlic? And she'd say, well, of course, garlic. You know, no Parmesan cheese? Well, of course, Parmesan cheese. So the only way to learn the recipes from her was to watch her cook. Mm. And that's what me and my sister Donna did. And we are the two that really emulate her food.
So when you cook, you operate in a similar kind of fashion. You do what feels right, not necessarily by the numbers.
Cooking at home, yes. I do the same thing. I go to the store, I see what looks good, I come home with it, and we cook. Baking is completely different. You have to be very, very accurate. And at school, of course, I measure and weigh and do all that to set the examples for the students, because that's what you have to do to maintain consistency in a restaurant.
So you're the chair now of the culinary department here at NOSI College of Art. I'm sure that as a person leading the culinary department and sort of setting the curriculum and figuring out not only how to teach students, but deciding what they need to learn, you know, your experience is vast, and the world, the restaurant industry, and the food industry that you came up in has changed a lot from what it is now. And wonder about sort of the difference between what you learned and how well that served you at the time in your professional career as a chef versus teaching these kids, knowing that they're going to have to walk in those same footsteps, but in a very different environment. That must require a little bit of adaptation on your part, or a lot.
Sure. The food we're cooking has changed, the style. You know, we're trying to cook a little bit more health conscious, and our clientele, our customers are more educated about food. But the basic principles of starting with the best ingredients, making sure that, you know, what you're putting out is the highest quality. And of course, the financial management aspect of it, you know, food cost, labor cost, all that has stayed the same or gotten a little bit harder as profit margins have gone down in rent and food costs have gone up. So the food changes a little bit. The business side pretty much stays the same. Restaurant industry is a tough industry to make money in.
Why do you think so many people are drawn to that, even though they sort of understand this is a tough business? I've never heard anybody say anything other than, man, the restaurant business is a tough business. Yet it seems to attract people. That's what they want to do. And it seems like they're just undaunted by those warnings. Man, this is going to be a really tough road to hoe.
Chefs are people who love to express themselves, and food is a great medium for the chefs to express themselves. It's really one of the only industries, if you're working in a single-owned restaurant where the chef is the owner, that, you know, there is no boss. There are no guidelines. You can really cook the food that you love. And also, you know, as a chef or an owner of a restaurant, we get what's called instant gratification. You know, we can cook a meal for a night on a Saturday night, cook 300 dinners at the end of the night, change our into a clean chef uniform, and walk out and talk to the customers. And, you know, that sometimes is the best part of the evening, you know, watching the people enjoy themselves. Or if you're a caterer, you know, having the mother or the bride come up to you and saying, you know, thank you so much. This was the best day of my life. It's a lot of instant gratification for what we're doing, as opposed to many jobs you wait for a quarterly report to see the results from your work. So, I mean, it's fun. There's a lot of stress. You have to follow the rules, the financial management rules. At the same time, if you love what you're doing, it's you're just drawn to it.
It seems like being a chef or being a cook, I'm not sure what the difference really is between the two. Maybe you can tell me. But it seems like people who like to cook for other people are nurturers. Like they want to give you something that they made. It's different than, it's a different kind of gift than a craft. Like I want to give you a pot that I made. It's, I want to give you nourishment. It just feels different to me somehow.
Yeah, we definitely have that in mind. It's what we send out into the dining room for the people is, you know, expression of ourselves. We enjoy when people enjoy our food. We all, it's hard to, you know, pin down the word for that, but if we send something out and, you know, the customer comes back and says, that was the best calamari I ever had in my life. It's like, you know, we get joy by making people happy. Hence, we're in the hospitality industry. That is our job. Unfortunately, some people in the industry forget that's our main job. But, you know, our job is to make people happy, to give, you know, every meal is a celebration. And we want to ensure that our customers, you know, both enjoy the meal and, you know, will remember the meal and hopefully come back and see us again.
I mean, your grandmother didn't cook for her. She cooked for you.
We were her customers, yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
That's an interesting idea, I think. I'm just trying to think of if that is included, if a part of that applies to what we do as photographers. And I know that much of what we do is, you know, product work or, you know, commercial stuff with where we're trying to show a location or a product or something like that. But when you're making someone's portrait, I think a lot of what we do is we see the person that we're photographing in a way that they cannot see themselves. They might not like their smile, or they might be self-conscious about a dimple or something like that. But we see that and find a, you know, that is something that's very interesting or beautiful about them. So what we try to do is photograph them in a way that conveys that back to them so that they can see it the way that we see it, right? And in those instances, when we're successful, I can identify with that feeling of being satisfied and happy that we've shown them a side of themselves that they never get to see, and that helps give them confidence in themselves. And it's a different, I mean, it's a much more personal interaction and result. And I think cooking is the same. It's personal.
Cooking definitely, you know, goes down to the basics of enjoyment. We feel that every meal in its own way is a celebration. We try to make that celebration, you know, carry that feeling of joy and satisfaction and camaraderie and friendship. You know, when a group of people sit down for a meal together, it's just a beautiful sight to see eight people at a table eating your food, laughing, telling stories. And, you know, we create that for them. That's kind of why we do it. We do it because we make people smile and laugh. And, you know, we are, in a word, people pleasers, of course. But it does, you know, tend to go deeper than that because food, you know, it's a staple that everyone needs and it keeps us alive and so such. But, you know, food is such, you know, a medium that you can stretch in so many different directions and, you know, watch the surprise on people's faces when they try something they've never tried before and go, oh my God. Veal sweetbreads are absolutely fantastic. And they sworn the day before that they would never eat them. Right. So it gives us surprises and it gives us joy.
It seems very personal. And if things don't go the way you planned, how do you deal with that? Like, how do you, it's your, you've kind of given a little piece of yourself to your clients. And if it doesn't go the way either you or they expected, that's going to be hard to take.
Anytime that happens in the industry, you know, if we're at a restaurant and a customer doesn't like a dish or, you know, there's something wrong, you know, every incident like that, looking at it from the business person's point of view, which you have to do, is an opportunity. You go out, you sit down at the table, you talk to them, you know, if they didn't like the dish, you kind of find out, you know, was it flavor, texture, something like that? God forbid if they found a foreign object in their food, like a hair or something like that. It's always an opportunity, and the way you handle it is very important, and you want to make sure that the people leave the restaurant feeling good about the experience they just had.
Do you feel like that applies to the mom and pop burger joint all the way up to the New York French? I mean, should it maybe apply all, across all different kinds of restaurants, or does it mostly apply to the higher end?
It should apply to all restaurants, but it's a, you know, a question of time. Mm. You know, can you get out in the dining room? Do you have the right people to go out and talk to the customers? Definitely probably happens more in the higher end restaurants, but, you know, in my mind, anywhere that serves food, you know, we have a saying, the customer may not always be right, but the customer is always the customer. Uh-huh. And our job is to have them leave our establishment with good memories.
I would say that's very similar to what we do also. I mean, how do you, Chris, how do you, if you're making a photo of someone for them and they, you can tell when they look, when they're looking at it, they're sort of like, oh, I don't, not feeling this, you know, that's also kind of a personal blow.
Mm-hmm, you know? Absolutely.
How do you handle that?
You just keep trying. Like you keep trying to figure out what it is that's going to make them happy. And, you know, to date in 30 years of photography, I've only made one person cry.
Mm-hmm. So besides
I got
you,
that going.
Besides yeah. yourself.
Well, that, yeah. Silently weeping to myself. Yes. Yeah. So I got that going for me. Yeah. I've only made one person cry. But yeah, you just have to, it is personal. And there are people that hate to have their photograph taken. And it's, you go into it thinking, well, hell, they may as well have just gone to the dentist, mm-hmm. you know, and that doesn't feel good. But ultimately, if you can turn that around and make it and please them and make them feel good about what just happened, that feels good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, some people have, they're biased against themselves and they're determined that they're not going to like the photo, like before they even show up. In fact, it's sometimes why they don't show up because they're just sure it's not going to turn out well. And sometimes we start from behind the eight ball. And when that happens, I think you said it best, Chef, it's an opportunity to understand the person, you know, a little bit better and try to get inside their head and figure out what you can do. And a lot of times it's just a technique right? You need to move the light, or you need to raise or lower the camera or something like that. And it's just a simple technique that will unlock that sense of satisfaction that you're hoping for.
We don't have any control over a person's previous experience with other photographers, just like you don't have control over a person's previous bad meal at another restaurant. So they may be coming into your restaurant with a little chip that you don't have any control over. You have to sort of manage.
That is true. We have to show every customer that, you know, a successful restaurateur will make sure that the customer feels at home. They feel that, you know, they're valued. The biggest thing is the customer needs to know that the cook, the server, and everyone else in the restaurant cares about them and about the experience they're about to have. And that is what makes a successful owner. And they have to care about the customers, both internal and external. They need to care about their employees and need to ensure that their customers have good experiences.
It almost seems like a restaurateur needs to be either creative and able to make a really cool environment and hire the right people and make the right food to serve, or be a business person. That seems like it's a hard thing to do both. Like, as the chef, you're not necessarily number crunching on the price of steak that week, are you?
Yes, you are.
Oh, okay.
As a chef, you're responsible for food and labor costs for the kitchen. Uh-huh. And you have to ensure that, you know, those fall within the parameters where the restaurant remains profitable.
Well, that's not really fair that you're in charge of the business side of it and the number crunching, as well as the creativity of making a menu.
We are.
Yeah.
Just like any business person, you have your segment that you're in charge of.
Yeah.
And, you know, who better than the chef to ensure that the food that we're purchasing is priced properly and that the labor we're bringing in to cook meals, you know, our projections are correct on the number of customers we're going to do that evening. And, you know, it's, chefing is both an art and a science. Oh. You know, the science is knowing the business side and keeping all the numbers straight. And the art is ensuring that you have the best crew in the kitchen cooking the food. And if your crew is happy, they will cook better food and your customers will be happy. It goes just like any other business. If your employees are happy, they will ensure or do their best to make sure that the customer is happy. The restaurant GM, whether it's the owner or somebody that the owner has hired, monitors the numbers that, you know, we're doing every week. You know, we do our food costs and labor costs and inventory every week if you're a good chef. But the owner has one thing in mind, and that's to ensure that the restaurant is profitable. The chef and the front of the house manager or the GM are the two people that make that possible by cooking the best food, setting the best ambiance, ensuring that the servers, you know, are the right people to be serving their clientele. And it all flows together as one large team.
It's interesting. As you've been talking, I've been trying to put myself in your shoes, both as the chef, you know, and the person who wants to please the customer. But also, again, comparing it to what we do. And there's one aspect, I believe, that is sort of a bedrock principle for both of our business models, and that's trust. And Chris, you tell me if you feel this way. I believe that if the client trusts that I have their best interest in mind and that I'm not going to make them look stupid or silly and that I'm going to communicate exactly what they want to communicate, then it unlocks a world of creativity for me because I have their trust and they will allow me to explore a little bit and try some things because they believe and they know that I'm on their team. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, and you're not trying to just be safe. Like when there's a time to be safe and there's a time to be a little riskier, but you have to have their trust first.
You have to have their trust first. How about you, Chef? Would you say that, I mean, that must play a big role.
Sure. Your customers in a restaurant have to know that, you know, if they've been there five times and they're bringing, you know, their friends there for the sixth time, that the food is going to be equivalent to what they've had before. And now, as, you know, culinary director of a school, you know, our clients are both our students that come in, you know, and have to trust that we have their best interest in mind. And also, when our students graduate, their employers who own the restaurants that they're going to go to work at have to trust us that we're sending them people that can, you know, help them run a successful restaurant.
Like a GM or a chef might help build the brand of a restaurant, you're now, in addition to training people to work in restaurants, you're building a brand for the school so that that can be a trusted name for graduates who come from this program, right?
That is correct. And that's one thing I love about NOCE College of Art. You know, if a student isn't right for the program and they're not doing the work, I'm under no pressure at all to, you know, put that student through the program. It's like the president of the college doesn't want me to graduate the most students. He wants to ensure that I graduate the best students possible that will fulfill the needs of our clients, who are the owners of the restaurants they're going to go work in.
Yeah, you start with the best ingredients.
That, you know, your cooks are one of the ingredients when they're putting your standardized recipes together.
Mm-hmm. I know your grandmother was a huge influence, but beyond that, what would you consider to be your other influences or who?
Sure. Where I did my apprenticeship, the chef Michel, you know, was a great French chef, and he, you know, wasn't the norm. He didn't scream and yell. And he was very happy when, you know, I left there and went up and got an executive chef job up in Boston. There are some chefs that I've watched all my life who have influenced how I cook and what I cook. Back when I was, you know, solely doing French food, Alain Ducasse was my hero. Right now, his restaurants have 13 Michelin stars, and I follow him to this day. He has different menus on his website, and I can go and look at them every day. Today, John Besh, you know, I'm a huge fan of his style of cooking, his New Orleans style. He keeps it simple. He makes sure the flavors of the center of the plate entree are not overpowered by other ingredients. Thomas Keller, Heston Blumenthal, you know, people say that, you know, they're the father of molecular gastronomy, but that word has been, you know, so misused. They are two chefs who ensure that the flavors of the food are the most important part of the dish. And, you know, the crazy garnishes and heights, and you get dishes that, you know, are a foot tall. It's like, you know, they may look absolutely beautiful, but when it comes down to it, is the food great? And that's, you know, the philosophy I have to follow.
I think that's cool. I took my son to a college when he was leaving high school. He wanted to be a marine biologist, and we went to this one college, and they were closed. There was no one there. And we got lucky enough to meet the head of the research department, and he gave us a tour of the facility, and it was really awesome. And at the end, he asked my son, so who are your influences? Who is your favorite marine biologist? And he was like, I don't know. Like he couldn't come up with a marine biologist, and I could see the guy's light switch off. Like he knew at that moment, I mean, this isn't going to work out. Thanks for coming. And if he had had a few people in mind, then that would have gained his respect, and it would have changed the conversation. So is that something you instill in your students, to know who they look up to, or to know who's doing what in the business?
That's something we definitely bring up and try to teach them. I interview every student who applies for NOSI College of Art, and I ensure, you know, that they know their chefing is not always fun, not always easy, and they have to have a plan of what they're going to do with their degree when they graduate from NOSI. Oh. A lot of students, especially here, don't know a lot of chefs. And, you know, we automatically, you know, first couple of days, we're like, you need to be following this person, this person, this person. Get on the internet, look up their menus, and look at especially, look at their food, look at the pictures, look at the way they're plating, especially the creativity that they're putting into the dish, which goes right back to you eat with your eyes first. The dish has to be beautiful, and the food has to taste great.
It's interesting to think, of course, there's that sort of buzzword for us, creativity. And you just referenced it in terms of how the meal would look on the plate. But in the kitchen, where do you feel you can be most creative? Or how are you creative?
In the kitchen, if I'm, you know, not, I don't have that creative fire when I walk in there. And, you know, I'm like, okay, I need to make something, I need to figure out the specials for the night. Me and a lot of chefs will do exactly the same thing. We'll walk in, you know, we'll go into the walk-in, look around, see what ingredients we have in there and say, okay, you know I'm safe with this ingredient, and this ingredient if we're in a rush and we're doing that for the night. For menu writing and items that, you know, we're going to cook over and over again that will take sometimes weeks and months to develop. And most of us start with the base idea of what we want to do, a couple of ingredients in mind, and then we just start practicing and cooking. And, you know, a good restaurateur will have a few customers that we can cook a dish for and send out to them and say, what do you think of this? What do you think of this? You know, a little panel, 4, 5, 6, 8 customers that, you know, we use as kind of a tasting board. And, you know, we listen to them, we listen to our customers, we listen to our servers, we listen to the other cooks, and we work on that dish until we think it's good enough to go on a menu.
So that's that. It's like treating your kitchen like a little laboratory, and having a panel of trusted, you know, judges who can evaluate you and give you honest feedback about things. And it sounds like it's a mix of a new idea I might have, but sort of filtered through my past experiences of knowing how to do something or knowing that something will work. And then it's like a combination. I'm sure you must surprise yourself all the time in the kitchen. Let me try this. Let me try this. Wow, that is way better than I thought. Or holy cow, that there's no way I'm putting that out.
That is true. And you get better with that over time. But one thing that is different, we don't think of the kitchen as a laboratory. We think of it as the world's best playground. We just go in there and we have fun. You know, it's not, if I put myself under pressure to create and say, I need to get this done in the next 3 days, my brain is going to focus on that and not just let the thoughts come into the mind. And, you know, everything becomes a jumble in your brain. And then all of a sudden it's like, it becomes perfectly clear what you need to do. And that's, you know, when the magic moment occurs.
I was about to ask you, but when Mark and I, we have 30 years each in the business, and I'm sure you do too. It just, from time to time, we have an idea or something sparks, and we'll set up a still life or invite a model in, or we'll shoot something just to get it out of off our chest. And I call it working out. It's a workout. We just kind of keep that muscle going. It sounds like, when you're working on specials, that that's what that is for you. It's, I mean, you have a goal that you need to create a dish, but are there times when you are able to just, something strikes you and you go into the kitchen and you think, you kind of associate two different items differently and you think, I'm going to try this. And you just kind of experiment without needing necessarily to have a dish at the end of it.
Sure. That happens all the time. It's, you know, a lot of my ideas, believe it or not, come when I'm laying in bed and trying to go to sleep.
Classic.
I'm just laying there and, you know, I'm going to myself, okay, I have some, you know, speckled bass in the walk-in. You know, what else do I have in there? And, you know, what should I try? And I'll lay there and I'll drive my wife crazy because there's a notebook sitting on my bedstand. And
thank
I'll grab
goodness.
It and write some things down and then fall asleep, wake up the next morning and try to read my own handwriting. But, you know, it's successful. I go in and I try it and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, I can't stress how fun it is to have, you know, that freedom to, you know, be able to express yourself and to just try different things. And sometimes they work, sometimes they don't. And it's just fun.
We have that same problem. We have a creative idea and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
We've actually problem of laying in bed going, oh, this would be great, you know, and I have my phone or an iPad and I'll pick out a note or something so I don't forget. And it's the same thing. If you don't capture those ideas, then they just blow away. And, you know, you may never even remember that you had the idea, you know, and mourn its loss. It'll just be something that inspired you in a moment, and because you didn't capture it, then it's gone, you know, which is sad. It's so sad. When you know it's time for you to come up with some new ideas, where do you start with that? How do you, for lack of a better way of expressing it, how do you manufacture those ideas?
As a chef, very few of our items come, you know, with completely from scratch. You know, we read cookbooks, we, you know, go through the internet, we try to find ideas, you know, we see a recipe and we'll go, yeah, you know, that recipe doesn't sound that great, but, you know, maybe if I did this or that and changed some items, it, you know, might be a successful dish. So, you know, if we're under pressure or under a timeline, I'll use that method a lot more than just going into the walk-in and staring at food until I come up with an idea. A lot of times, you know, we'll take items that we've made in the past and say, okay, and believe me when I say this, I have 2 4-drawer filing cabinets at my house with every special I've ever made in my life. And I'll pull out a book from like 1978 and flip through it and say, wow, I mean, this was good then. What can I do to make it good for today? So we have an incredible amount of past material, which grows and grows and grows as you unfortunately age.
Is that like a catalog that you could sell? Like if you decided to retire, like could you take that and consider it a catalog and could you license it or sell it, or what happens to your catalog when you retire?
When I retire, I'm not going to stop cooking.
Right, right.
I actually have no idea. You know, a lot of cooks keep those sort of things. You know, my wife says, you should write a cookbook. And we actually do have a family cookbook, but it's just published by a little publishing company for immediate people around the family. But I have no idea what will occur with that. I'll definitely hang on to it until I'm no longer on this earth, and then it'll be up to my wife.
It just seems like there'd be, like you said, a cookbook or some anthology of your work that would kind of be your sort of life story. It seems to me like that's a good representation of your chef life.
If I was Anthony Bourdain or Thomas Keller, that would probably sell. It probably would not sell for Anthony Mandriotta.
I don't know. You might be surprised.
I have a question about, you mentioned having like a trusted group of people that you could sort of let taste test your ideas and creations. If you had somebody like that, or you took those people and you had them in a room and people just brought in like, here's a dish, try this dish. Here's another dish, try this dish. How are those people, or how would a person know when an Anthony Mandriota dish was in front of them? What would their experience be that would cause them to go, you know, I think I know who did this? In other words, what is sort of a hallmark of your food? Like, how would people know, oh, I know who's responsible for this?
That is a tough question. you know, everybody has a different style. I try to achieve the flavors that I want with as few ingredients as possible. I don't like dishes, you know, with 20 different herbs and spices in them. I want the flavor of the, say it's a beautiful piece of Chilean sea bass that I got. I want the dish to taste like Chilean sea bass, and the sauce and the accompaniments to enhance the flavor of that dish. So, I mean, I do, you know, try to keep my dishes relatively simple, make sure that the food tastes like the food that it started out to taste like. Some chefs, you know, will do this and that and add so many different ingredients to dishes that you're kind of confused as to exactly what you're eating. You know, if I send out, you know, Chilean sea bath, starch and veg and, you know, a couple of different, you know, salsas or picos on it, they'll all complement the center of the plate, but not overpower, if that answers your question.
It helps me certainly understand sort of the foundation on which your meals are sort of based. You know, I know a chicken-based meal will taste different than a fish, will taste different than a bolognese or something, or a classic French. It's, we talk about style a lot because, I mean, I have a style, Chris has a style, all photographers that we know have styles, film directors have styles, everybody has a style. And recognizing it yourself, about yourself, is difficult sometimes, but ask any of your friends and they'll say, I can tell you exactly what your style is. You know, do you find that to be true?
I guess the friends that I cook for at my house, I have a very eclectic bunch of friends. But if I'm cooking Italian, everything else that I cook is kind of, you know, my style is, you know, keep it simple, do all that. But if somebody went into a restaurant and had an Anthony Mandriota made meatball or an Anthony Mandriota made hot Italian sausage, they would say, I know who made that. Or the red sauce, it's like, which of course we call gravy in Italy. Mm-hmm. They would be like, that's Anthony Mandriota's recipe. Mm. My style is, it comes right back down to those three statements. Start with the best ingredients, you know, keep it simple, don't crowd your pan, eat with your eyes first. And that's what I do. Last night for dinner, I made flounder grenoblas, which is just flounder with capers and lemons, white wine, and beurre blanc, and some plain old steamed white rice and some green beans. Actually, haricot vert, if you want to say it in French. And that's just a simple French meal.
What did you have for dinner last night?
I did not have dinner. I got home after the thing we did last night, and I was hungry.
Yeah. Oh.
I did not have dinner.
Did you eat after you got home?
No.
Oh.
No, I did not.
I had a split of pad thai and a massaman curry with my niece, and they were both delicious, you know. But it was takeout, so, you know, kind of cheating a little bit.
So let's say that I come to you and I say, Chef, I want to be a chef. And you are going to try and talk me out of it. What are the top couple of reasons that you would give me that are sort of challenges or obstacles or difficulties in being a chef that you would recommend you shouldn't, and here's why?
I'll leave out the financial part.
Yeah.
I'd say my first question would be, do you like people?
Uh-huh.
Can you deal with people who are not the friendliest of people in the mm-hmm. world? Are you willing to work 12 hours in a 120-degree kitchen, and if you're owning your own restaurant, only breaking even or possibly losing money for the first 2 years of your business?
I've heard that a lot of restaurants go under in the first 2 years, and that you're confirming what I've heard.
About 70% of restaurants do not survive for 2 years. The ones that do survive are the ones that both cook good food and have a good, solid idea of the financial management of a restaurant, which is completely different from any other chain of business. You know, retail stores, they run, you know, on a completely different set of books.
It seems like marketing is a whole different thing too, because, I mean, a lot of what you have control over would be the word of mouth marketing. Like if there's a bunch of people that, like you mentioned, the eight people sitting down at your table to eat, one of those eight probably said, you know what, we ought to go to Chef Mandriota's place. So you want to encourage and treat that everyone right so that they become a salesperson for you in a group setting to get the group to come to you.
That's absolutely correct. In the restaurant business, word of mouth is our main form of marketing. You don't see commercials on televisions for, you know, single-owned restaurants, family-owned restaurants, things like that. Without word of mouth, you know, we'll go nowhere. And we also have a very small area in which to pull our guests from. 90% of the guests for a restaurant come from within a 5-mile radius of the restaurant. Those other 5%, they're coming because they've eaten there, they loved it, and they're willing to drive. That's the general rule. There are exceptions to that, you know, destination restaurants, but generally speaking, you survive off your regulars.
Well, what do they say? If you treat a customer right, they'll tell 5 friends. If you treat them wrong, they'll tell 100 friends.
Unfortunately, that is true.
Yeah. So that gets back to being a people person and being able to communicate with your clients or customers and make sure that they're happy when they leave.
And recognize that opportunity that you mentioned.
It all ties together.
Yeah.
Yes. It's the total experience. And it's kind of funny because you mentioned, you know, visual. When you're pulling into a restaurant, you look at the outside of the building and you start to form your impression of that restaurant. If you pull into the parking lot and there's a couple of broken beer bottles there that nobody's swept up, it's like it starts right there.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I've often thought that if you were like a professional hairstylist, how hard that would be to walk around a downtown because all you see is people's haircuts. And you're like, terrible. Awful. So when you go to a restaurant, are you able to put aside kind of the critique or I wouldn't have done that, I wouldn't have done that, I like that, and just enjoy the meal? Or how do you go out to eat?
I generally choose my restaurants carefully, but, and it's kind of funny, if me and my wife are only with each other, her being, you know, a former restaurant manager and me being a chef, we will, you know, do a little bit of nitpicking about it. But my general philosophy is if somebody else cooked it for me, it's absolutely wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Back to this idea about opportunity, it just occurred to me that probably one of the biggest areas of creativity that we practice as small business owners or people who are responsible for what we do is in recognizing the opportunity. I've had so many conversations with people who say, this person made me mad, or this person told me no, or this person, you know, refused to pay me or whatever. And that's the end of the line for those people, or so they think. And I think the better way, the essential way to think is that's actually the beginning of your problem, right? That you haven't been stopped or denied, and that's not the end of the thing. It's the point where you need to say, okay, where is the opportunity here? And that can be very difficult and require a lot of thought and changing perspectives to try and understand what is the opportunity here. Personally, I believe there always is an opportunity there, but can you ferret it out? Can you decide and figure out what it is? That's difficult.
In the restaurant world, that is an art form, trying to determine what we need to do to make that customer happy and to ensure that when they leave the restaurant, they're not going to be telling 100 friends, you know, they had a bad experience. We do that in a number of ways, but we always try to make sure that when they leave, they're going to leave, you know, thinking they had a good experience. And sometimes it does just come down to, you know, sitting down, talking to the customer and, you know, being honest with the customer. Okay, my kitchen made a mistake. You didn't have a good meal. What can I do to make up for that? And some people, you know, that's not my favorite way of doing it. I'd rather come up with the idea myself. But sometimes that is the best approach to take with people, no matter what business you're in.
So when you're not in the kitchen working or preparing meals, what kind of hobbies do you have? What other things do you like to do that's not necessarily in the kitchen?
Okay. I like to garden. I grow a lot of my own vegetables. During the summer, I'll walk out there and pick items and say, okay, what can I cook that goes along with this? Farmers markets are great. I love them. Farmers markets are another area where you can get, you know, really increase your creativity. There's items that often you see there that you wouldn't see in a normal store. So I love walking around, talking to the vendors, especially with all the new heirloom tomatoes and heirloom vegetables that are coming out. There are some great mushroom farms that are finally starting to sell at summer markets. And I love going into stores and finding ingredients that surprise me. K&S is one of my favorite stores. It's almost like a field trip when I go there. I go there and look at the fish and talk to the people behind the counter and say, what should I buy? And they'll always have, you know, some good words about certain ingredients, and just putting all those items together, going to the farmer's market, stopping at K&S on the way home, grabbing some fish. It all comes together into, you know, a really pleasurable experience. Cooking, but not feeling any stress or any pressure about anything I need to cook. And there is one other thing I haven't really talked about, de-stressing when you get home. If I've had a bad week and I need to be de-stressed, I will walk into my kitchen, grab my flour, grab my yeast, grab my water, and spend a day or two making bread. Awesome. Making bread is a completely zen experience. You're under no pressure. Your yeast is forming, your bread is rising, you're just, you know, watching all this occur, and then baking the bread, making your house smell wonderful, popping it in the freezer and knowing that you don't have to go out to a grocery store and buy something that at one time resembled something called wheat. making your own bread is a great relaxation method that I employ all the time.
I am big on bread. I'll do bread with every meal. Like there's no excuse to not have bread with a meal, in my opinion.
I try not to have bread with every meal because I try to keep my weight under control, right. But I would, trust me.
Well, it's been really great to meet you today, and I've heard a little bit about you through Mark, and I learned a lot about what it's like to be in the kitchen. I'm not a chef at all. But
you're an appreciator of chefs.
I am. I appreciate the work you do, and it's really, really great meeting you today.
Well, thank you.
Chef Mandriotta, where can people learn more about you online?
On the NOSI website, there's my bio is on the website. It's pretty extensive. I'm on LinkedIn if you want to see my resume and how my business career, how my chefing career got started. It goes all the way back to Le Soir. I've cooked in a lot of different venues, done a lot of different things, so they can pretty much look there.
And what if they want to taste some of your food, what day should they just randomly show up at your house? Weekends best or weekdays or?
Chez Mandriotta is an exclusive club.
Oh, I see. private club members only.
Private club members only, yes. And please don't raid my garden.
Before we wrap up, we like to ask our guests a question, and we will participate as well. And the question is, what is it you're looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to our new student start in May. Mm. We have some new students coming in. And I'm looking forward to the three new classes that we're teaching in May, classes we haven't taught before. We get into European and Mediterranean cuisine, which is one of my favorite classes to teach. Mm. And we also start to teach our financial management class, which, believe it or not, I am a geek. I am one of those strange people that loves accounting. And while we don't teach accounting, we teach the students how to understand the numbers that go into accounting. So, and I'm looking forward to some warm weather.
Excellent. Excellent. Mark, what are you looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to, let's see, we're recording this on a Friday. Next week, I have 5 consecutive days of work. 2 of them are in Atlanta. And I know by this time next week, I'm going to be exhausted. So I'm looking forward to 2 Saturdays from today coming off a really busy work week.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to something that's happening tomorrow night, which is we entered a contest for the Nashville Opera, and we created a short film that is going to precede the opera tomorrow night. And the opera is Rigoletto. And so we get to go and watch our film open for the opera, which is going to be really awesome. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, I guess I'm looking forward to that too. So we want to thank Chef Mandriotta for coming on the show today. And we also want to thank our sponsor, NOSI College of Art.
Creativity in Motion is produced by the team at Penumbra Entertainment. If you liked this show, please subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss an episode. And if you really liked it, the best way you can support us is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher. Or on Spotify, you can rate the show right from the show's page in the Spotify app.
Follow Penumbra Entertainment on Facebook and Instagram. On both platforms, we are Penumbra Films. If you'd like show notes and occasional bonus content for this or any other episode, please make your way to our website at penumbra-ent.com. And if you have questions, we would love to hear from you. Please send them to us at creativity@penumbra-ent.com. Especially if you have ideas, thoughts about the show, and if you know someone that you think would make a good guest for the show, we would love to know who that is. We hope you'll join us on the next episode of the Creativity in Motion podcast. In the meantime, don't forget that creativity can often open doors you didn't even know existed.